You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row.
I'm Emma Louise Fenlon and I'm here with Richard Scorer. Richard has many years' experience dealing with serious injury and child abuse cases, and he has acted in many abuse cases against the Catholic Church and other organisations. He currently acts for a large number of clients in the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse, or ICSA. Welcome, Richard.
Hello.
The inquiry had a rocky start to begin with, and various discussions were had about how it should be structured, including the suggestion that a less legalistic model be used. Can you tell us a little bit about this and why you think it was important that a forensic courtroom approach was ultimately chosen?
When the inquiry began in 2014, it began as a non-statutory panel inquiry, so it didn't have statutory powers. Then in 2015, Theresa May, who was Home Secretary at that time, decided to convert the inquiry into a statutory inquiry under the Inquiries Act 2005. So this means that it has statutory powers, so it can compel witnesses, force bodies to disclose documentation and so forth. The concern was obviously that many institutions being scrutinised by the inquiry have been involved in covering up abuse. And the only way to bring the truth out into the open would be to ensure that the inquiry had the legal powers to compel the disclosure of documents and, if necessary, compel witnesses to attend. The inquiry hasn't necessarily had to exercise many of those powers of compulsion, but the fact that it has them probably means that it gets a level of cooperation from the institutions that it's looking at that it might not get otherwise.
And can you tell us a little bit about how the hearing room itself works and how proceedings operate?
So as we've been saying, this is a statutory inquiry exercising legal powers. So in many ways, the hearing room feels a bit like a courtroom. You have a chair, Alexis Jay, exercising judicial powers, although she isn't herself a judge. The three other panel members are all lawyers. Ivor Frank and Drew Sharpling have both been legal practitioners. Sir Malcolm Evans is an academic lawyer. So that's the panel. Then you have the core participants and the lawyers representing them. A core participant is somebody who the inquiry has recognised as having an interest in the proceedings, for example, as a victim of the abuse being investigated or as one of the institutions under investigation. Virtually all of the core participants are legally represented and their lawyers are present throughout the hearings. And then day to day, the key person driving the proceedings is counsel to the inquiry, or CTI in the shorthand. CTI is the senior barrister appointed by the inquiry to drive the investigation, and it's actually CTI who does the vast majority of questioning of the witnesses. Very little of the questioning of the witnesses is actually done by the lawyers representing core participants, although they can suggest lines of questioning, and we frequently do, but most of the actual questioning is done by CTI. The fact that the inquiry operates in that way, the fact that CTI does most of the questioning, that's a change which has come about as a result of the Inquiries Act 2005, which introduced new procedures for the management of inquiries. The background to that, of course, was a concern that if you didn't have some method of controlling the process of questioning of witnesses, then it could become very protracted and inquiries could become very prolonged. The most notorious example of that, obviously, was the Bloody Sunday inquiry, which lasted, I think, for 13 years. So what happens now is that lawyers for core participants have to submit questions in advance to the chair. In this inquiry, we technically have to do that 4 days in advance of a witness giving evidence. The chair then decides whether permission is going to be given for the question to be asked. But even if the question is permitted, it's often actually asked by CTI rather than by the lawyer who suggested the question. And because of that process, this inquiry, I think, has a different feel to inquiries that I've been involved with in the past. For example, as you said earlier, I was very involved in the Waterhouse inquiry into abuse of children in care in North Wales. That was in the 1990s. It was a statutory inquiry under the 1921 Act. And when witnesses gave evidence, the lawyers for the different parties would then stand up and ask questions one after the other. That doesn't really happen now in the same way. That can feel frustrating because as lawyers in the inquiry, we don't have the same latitude to ask questions ourselves. We have to apply on notice. But equally, I suppose it does mean that hearings tend to finish on time. What it also means is that the counsel to the inquiry is an absolutely central figure in the process, and having a good CTI is absolutely critical to making the inquiry work effectively. That's obviously always been true with inquiries, even before the Inquiries Act 2005, but I think it's even truer now.
You represent victims and survivors involved in a number of different modules of ICSA, including abuse in the Catholic Church, incorporating abuse at the Archdiocese of Birmingham and the English Benedictine congregation within the Anglican Church, and victims of people associated with Westminster. Have any themes emerged?
Well, I've been involved in three major hearings so far, one relating to a group of care homes in Rochdale and two relating to the churches. As you've said, we had the Catholic Church hearing last December, looking at a Catholic monastic order, the English Benedictine congregation, and then we had the Anglican Church hearing in March. I think in the church hearings, there were several key themes which came out very powerfully. One is the tendency of the churches to want to deal with abuse allegations in-house. In other words, keeping the allegations within the church rather than passing them to the police to investigate. People have quite rightly described this as cover-up. I've also described it as the church trying to mark its own homework. But whatever you call it, there's been quite a marked resistance in the churches to being investigated by secular authorities. And I think that reflects a deeper cultural problem in the churches of a tendency to put the interests and the reputation of the institution before the interests of children. And it's one, in my view, that's still going on. We saw in the Catholic hearings how one of the schools being investigated had put in place quite a lot of paperwork and paper systems relating to child protection. But the actual evidence was that the culture hadn't really changed. In reality, children were still at risk. Interestingly, in that particular case, following the inquiry hearing, the Charities Commission decided to intervene with that school. The school is also a charity, and it was put into special measures in regard to safeguarding.
One of the criticisms that has come up on numerous occasions relates to failure to report allegations of abuse to the police. Can you tell us a bit about this?
We've seen a succession of cases in the churches where serious allegations of abuse have been known to the church hierarchy but haven't been reported to the statutory authorities. So in the Catholic hearing last year, we heard about cases from Downside and Ampleforth where priests were known to have committed sexual offences against children. In some cases, they actually admitted it, but the allegations weren't passed to the secular authorities, in other words, to police or social services for investigation. We also know that this happened in the case of Peter Ball, a Church of England bishop. We know that that senior figures in the Church of England knew about serious allegations against him, but these were withheld from the police over a period of nearly 20 years. So it's clearly been a significant problem, particularly in the churches.
What is it about the particular characteristics of religious culture that create a moral hazard?
I think that many institutions, and this applies both to secular and religious institutions, have had a tendency to try to cover up abuse. So this isn't unique to the churches. However, I think that institutions have a particular tendency to try to cover up abuse where they depend for their survival on their reputation. So reputation is a key issue. And of course, the churches do rely especially on reputation. They want to be seen as good. That's why they claim to exist. As I put it in one of my submissions to the inquiry, the Catholic Church claims to be a moral beacon in society. So if the Catholic Church doesn't look to people as if it's better than the world around it, then what's the point of it, you could argue. And the problem with abuse is that it undermines that claim about the church. So the churches do have a powerful incentive to cover up abuse. And if they get a reputation, as they have done, for being places where abuse gets covered up, then inevitably they attract more abusers. They become honeypots, as it were. I think the other compounding figure in religious settings is what we might call clericalism. In other words, the belief that the clergy are good people who couldn't possibly do anything wrong. That's a very powerfully ingrained idea in both the Catholic and the Anglican churches, and we've seen the consequences of that exposed very powerfully in the two hearings that we've had so far.
The inquiry has involved disclosure of vast numbers of documents going back decades. Can you describe some of the challenges you've encountered in relation to disclosure?
Well, the volume of document disclosure we've seen in the inquiry has been very substantial, and that's actually probably an understatement. It's been huge. Some of the investigations we've dealt with have given rise to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of documents. And I think that's inevitable given the nature of the investigations, but it does present some logistical challenges, both for the inquiry itself and for core participants. The inquiry obviously has to inspect the documents it receives from the various institutions and make appropriate redactions, consider what can be disclosed. So that's a very sizable task. And then the core participants and their lawyers have to read the documents. So that presents significant challenges, particularly where we get disclosure late in the day, either just before hearings are about to start or indeed whilst they're still going on. And that's a particular problem at times, bearing in mind what I've said before about the need to submit questions to the chair in advance.
And victims and survivors have been granted anonymity for the most part, as have some witnesses giving evidence. Can you describe the protective measures used by the inquiry to facilitate evidence and tell us how this has affected the inquiry?
So there are a number of measures used to protect victims and survivors, and as you say, the most important is anonymity. Obviously, anyone who's the victim or alleged victim of a sexual offence has a statutory right to anonymity anyway. But the inquiry reinforces that by making what's described as a restriction order, which prohibits the publication or broadcasting not only of the identity of the victim or survivor, but also the publication of material which could indirectly identify him or her, in other words, what we call jigsaw identification. It's also worth noting, however, that the inquiry also extends that same protection to individuals who have been accused of abuse but haven't been convicted of it. So, in fact, that anonymity applies not just to complainants and victims, but it also applies to some of those who are accused of abuse, although not to those who have been convicted, because obviously that's a matter of public record anyway.
And am I right in understanding that this has created all sorts of issues in relation to the ciphers given to those who have been accused but not convicted of child sexual abuse? Because very often these same people are identified when they are being spoken about as people in positions of authority.
Yes, sometimes that can give rise to practical difficulties. The way the inquiry operates is that the proceedings are broadcast, but there's a time delay between the actual evidence being given and the evidence being broadcast publicly. So sometimes within hearings, it's necessary to stop the broadcasting tape so that some of these issues can be addressed if, for example, information's been disclosed which might identify an individual and it shouldn't have been disclosed, the tape is stopped so that it can be redacted before broadcast.
On the 25th of April, the chair of ICSA, Professor Alexis Jay, published an interim report outlining 18 initial recommendations. Can you tell us a little bit about this report?
So this is the inquiry's first general interim report. We've had other reports relating to some of the individual investigations, like the child migrant investigations, like Rochdale. But this is the first general report. It highlighted a number of themes considered by the inquiry so far, for example, around the prevalence of abuse and the need for some changes in the treatment of victims within the criminal justice and civil justice processes. And it contained a number of recommendations, as you say, although I think the more substantive recommendations will come later on.
One of the criticisms that has been made of ICSA relates to delay. The chairwoman indicated that she expects the inquiry to have made substantial progress by 2020. How has delay affected the proceedings?
I think it's fair to say that for the first 2 years or so of the inquiry, there was a feeling that, or certainly outside the inquiry, there was a feeling that it was making very little progress. I think that's changed now. I think we've had four very substantial hearings with several more to come this year. So there's certainly a sense of greater progress. I think one of the issues the inquiry's had to contend with right from the start is the fact that when it was originally set up by Theresa May, there was actually very little attempt at that point on the part of the politicians who were arguing for it to communicate what it was seeking to do and how it would actually work. The Home Secretary didn't really make any attempt to communicate those issues to the wider public. So, for example, it wasn't properly explained that the inquiry isn't like a criminal court. It's not really in the business of making findings against individuals. So I think the inquiry is still struggling in many ways to deal with the legacy of those of that failure at the outset to communicate what it was about, what it was seeking to do, and what the limitations of it were. But hopefully that's changing now.
Can you describe what success for victims and survivors looks like?
I think for most of the complainants and victims I represent, there are two key issues which they want to see the inquiry address, which are, in a sense are related. One is around independent oversight of institutions, so they aren't left to please themselves and they can't conceal things that have gone wrong. So, for example, with the Church of England, we're arguing for the establishment of an independent oversight body. The other issue is mandatory reporting. In other words, having a legal regime which ensures that all allegations or suspicions of abuse within the context of regulated activities are reported to the statutory authorities. And that means having a degree of legal compulsion for it. In other words, having legal sanctions if you know about abuse in a regulated setting like a youth club or a church, and if you don't report it. For most of my clients, I think that's the one thing that they feel will potentially change the culture of these institutions where cover-ups have taken place.
On mandatory reporting, has this been tried elsewhere with success?
It's certainly been done elsewhere, and in fact, most civilised countries have some form of mandatory reporting law. If you ask the general public in this country, do you think, for example, if a teacher knows about a child being abused in a school, is there a legal obligation to report that? Most people would think that there is. Most people would say, yes, of course there's a legal obligation to report that. Actually, in Britain, they're wrong. There isn't any such formal legal obligation. But we're very clear that there must be and there should be. And that's one of the issues we want the inquiry to address.
LawPod UK is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.